It's Philosophy Talk.
What sports explains us, and the frenzy about sports explains in present-day society, is not so much a need, but a restlessness about what to do with our bodies.
Is the beauty of athletics basically due to the seeming effortlessness of the athlete?
Aren't championships and goals what attract people to sports?
The least mentioned among the important reasons, the important attractives of sports, can be described in the most canonical philosophical way as aesthetic experience.
Our guest, Hans Gumbrecht from Stanford University.
It is all about being lost in focused intensity. Being lost in focused intensity. And I think in the first place, a very, very beautiful, compact description that works both for the spectator and for the athlete.
Athletic beauty.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk, after the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local and innovative public radio for San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the beautiful Stanford campus.
And from that oasis of thought, we migrate to this oasis of the air, and from the air to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. So, John, I have a question for you. Give me a list of your most intense aesthetic experiences.
Intense aesthetic experiences.
Most beautiful things you've ever witnessed.
Most beautiful things. Well, okay. So my favorite is sitting on the deck with a nice glass of scotch watching a beautiful sunset. And then as the scotch continues to flow, watching the stars come out. Even your man Kant liked the starry heavens. He thought it was somehow important, right?
Yeah.
I like ballet, some parts of it. I like beautiful human bodies, particularly some more than others. I like to sit along the ocean and watch the sea come in endlessly.
Lots of aesthetic experiences. You're really into nature and a little bit into art. But I know you're an avid sports fan, and I'm surprised that you left out athletic competitions. Haven't you ever seen a beautifully played football game or baseball game or gymnastics performance?
Some of my most memorable experiences are from watching sports. Just take one, Dwight Clark's catch, what we call the catch in the Bay Area. Everybody knows what we're talking about. January 10th, 1982, San Francisco for the first time under Bill Walsh, the former Stanford coach, beats Dallas for the conference championship. Wow, that was something. But beautiful? Was it beautiful?
The pass and the leap and the falling into the end zone? Isn't that beautiful?
No, it was one of Montana's typically wobbly but on-target passes and one of Dwight Clark's typically, you know, kind of klutzy but successful catches.
I think you have a philosopher's prejudice. Philosophers, when they think about the aesthetic and the beautiful, they always think about high art and high culture and nature, but they never, ever think about sports. I mean, you said it in the opening. Which grips people more, you know, basketball or ballet? I mean, people are intensely, and that intense pleasure they take is an aesthetic appreciation of the beauty of the thing, at least in part.
So you're going to convince, I mean, I'm sort of convinced, you know, when people say I have philosopher's prejudice, well, why shouldn't I? But demolition derbies, tractor pulling contests, NASCAR, you're going to convince me this is all beautiful, huh?
Well, look, there's lots of complexity. There are lots of different kinds of sports with lots of different kind of internal dynamics, and we'll have to explore that. You know, we've been talking about this from the spectator's perspective, but our roving philosophical reporter, Pauly Stryker, went out and talked to some participants in various sports and got their take on the aesthetic character of sports. She files this report.
Everyone has a favorite sport they love to watch, a gymnast doing a backflip, or wrestlers locked together. There's a draw to every sport, the danger, the physiques. I spoke with coaches and athletes in sumo wrestling and gymnastics. UC Berkeley's head gymnastics coach, Carrie Dubois, explained the dedication.
Starting out with a lot of these young athletes, and as they progress, you know, if they're competitive, they're training at least 20 hours a week, if not up to 40 or 50 hours a week at the highest level. I traveled an hour to practice and an hour back, and a lot of these ladies do that all through their elementary, middle, and high school years. And so it was a two-hour drive every day plus a four-hour workout 5 days a week.
Staying in shape for gymnastics is a year-round challenge.
We lift weights, we swim, we run stadiums. Our athletes work with a nutritionist, so if they're not getting enough carbs, how can they work on their diet to where they're eating what they need to help repair their body and get it ready for practice the next day?
I asked gymnast Justine Cephas, a senior on the Cal Women's Gymnastics team, about the allure and the danger of what she does.
Usually I'm worried about technique. It's, you know, when you let your mind slip that you lose focus, that I think you get hurt. And I think that is part of the draw. You know, people like to see, you know, crashes, whether it's NASCAR or gymnastics, but they also like to see, you know, the big flips. And, you know, I mean, that's like, you know, a huge sense of accomplishment that you can do something that so few people can do and that it really is dangerous. But with proper technique and conditioning, you know that you'll be fine.
One, two, three, go!
It's not a big leap from gymnastics to sumo wrestling in terms of aesthetic appeal and the rigors of the sport. Andrew Freund is president of the California Sumo Association and director of the U.S. Sumo Open.
There's a couple things that are very attractive about sumo, and one factor that's attractive in professional sumo is the incredibly detailed ritual and ceremony. They're throwing salt, they're doing the shiko, which is like the stomping. There's so much beauty and grace to what they're doing in professional sumo, and I think that attracts a lot of attention in Japan and around the world.
Pro sumo in Japan guards its ranks closely, with only 800 or 900 wrestlers. Meanwhile, amateur sumo, like Freund's California Sumo Association, is getting popular as a serious sport for everyone else.
Someone could watch sumo for the first time and grasp the basics because it's so simple. You either want to push the opponent out of the ring or you want to push the opponent down to the ground. There's surprise moves, people are flipping others. The course of the match could change in a split second.
Part of sumo's appeal is the David versus Goliath nature of it. Take the famous pro sumo example of 600-pound Konishiki versus 200-pound Mainomi. First, Mainomi was too short to get into pro sumo.
So he went back to a doctor, got a silicon implant in the top of his head, and he was finally admitted to join pro sumo when he came back at the height of 5'7". Imagine these two guys, 650-pound Konishiki and 210-pound Mainomi. During the course of their professional careers, they had 10 matches against each other, and believe it or not, Mainomi won 6 of those matches.
Freund coaches 275-pound Dan Kalbfleisch, a rising amateur sumo wrestler who's the current California Openweight and Heavyweight champion.
Before a tournament, I like to do a lot of heavy weight training, especially the legs to gain strength, and the chest, especially when I'm using a slapping motion. Many people don't realize that it's not just the fat. I mean, there's a lot of muscle underneath that fat. I also do a lot of cardio training. Although the matches are only 10 seconds, I want to be able to recover quick for my next match.
Does Kalbfleisch think sumo is beautiful?
Just like any sport, I think it's beautiful to see the human body doing what it does, you know, moving in the way that the human body does. I think people love to see that in motion, and it definitely is beautiful.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Polly Stryker.
Thanks, Polly, for that report. Athletic beauty from women's gymnastics to sumo wrestling. Wow. I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
Quite a range. You know, I love sumo. It's an amazing sport. And we're joined today by Hans Gumbrecht, who's a professor of comparative literature at Stanford University. He's author of many things, but particularly pertinent to our topic today, In Praise of Athletic Beauty. Hans, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, guys. Why don't you call me Sepp, as always?
Okay, we'll do that.
Sepp, John Perry, I've got a question for you. Given there's some beauty connected, there's athletic beauty, I give you that, right? I mean, and I'll praise it along with your book. Beautiful book, by the way. Nicely produced, wonderfully written. But still, do you really think people watch sports for the beauty of it? Don't they really watch because they care about their seeing their team or their favorite player win or winning a bet? No matter how well or badly the game or match is played, isn't it that competition and the home team and the favorite player that remain the magnet that draws us to sports?
Yeah, I have no doubt. I mean, if you ask people, you know, if you would conduct interviews, that's what people would say. I want to support my team. I want my team to win. I have a bet going. We have a colleague at Stanford who I think is into the aesthetic of sports, but he would always say it's about a bet. So I think it's part of the culture and the discourse of sports to say it's not about aesthetic beauty. And I mean, when I'm trying out my own thesis on fans, some of them hate it, you know? I mean, kind of a typical proletarian crowd for soccer games in Europe. If you tell them, Leeds United or Manchester United fan that they are attracted by the beauty of the game. They would, I mean, I cannot say in the San Francisco program what they would say, but they would say something very homophobic, and this is not what they're into. So I give you that, but that's precisely because I thought there's a book in there, because if it was so evident, why would you write a book about it?
Well, I spent a frightening hour once on a train from London. I was headed for Nottingham, but until we got to Manchester, it was full of Manchester United fans. And I have to agree with you. If you ask them, which I wouldn't have had the courage to do, they would not have mentioned athletic beauty.
But so wait a minute. So have you just refuted your own book? I thought the book was about athletics as a theater of beauty,
well,
and watching it as a distinctive and glorious kind of aesthetic experience.
No, I mean, the book, you know, and most of the 200 plus pages tries to push the hypothesis that at least the least mentioned among the important reasons, the important attractives of sports, can be described in the most canonical philosophical way as aesthetic experience. That's one thing, and that I try to maintain. On the other hand, however, I think for a number of reasons, this is not being talked about. I mean, one reason being that beauty, the aesthetic, to many sports fans, not to all sports fans, sounds kind of sissy. That would be an acceptable word, right?
Yeah.
And then, I mean, the other reason is that intellectuals talking about it don't like, I mean, intellectuals always want to redeem, to liberate proletarians. That's part of our mission. But they don't like proletarians to make aesthetic experience. That's no good. I mean, the Leeds United fan, no. Or, you know, the Giants fan, no. That's something. They are being exploited and so forth.
Well, now, you know, in America, a lot of intellectuals' role is not aimed at the proletarian, but at the rich, right? There's this whole neocon movement. Before we get into there, I want to get back to your basic thesis. Mm. You say it's an aesthetic experience, but you're not just using that word for its emotive value. You've got in mind Kant's criteria of what makes something aesthetic.
Well,
why don't you explain that?
What's an aesthetic experience?
Yeah, I mean, okay. I mean, now I feel like, you know, I'm an exam with real philosophers. So, I mean, I'm saying the judgment you make when you say after this was a beautiful game or a good game, the way you make that is exactly, it has the same features that Kant describes as the specificity of the aesthetic judgment. First of all, it's disinterested, so to make a long story short, it's disconnected from any everyday interest. You don't like a game because you think that will increase your banking account or something like that. Then second, you make a judgment and you feel somehow capable of making judgment without having measurements or stable concepts. You couldn't argue why you find that game beautiful, but you feel it's beautiful. And then the third one, which I think is the most amazing one that Kant talks about, it is not that it necessarily produces consensus, but you have the feeling that everybody has to agree. So if you like the game, you have a hard time understanding that somebody else says, well, yeah, okay, your team won, but it still was a good game. That's the least thing you expect. Doesn't always happen, but these are three features that I think perfectly apply to the sports experience.
That last one is a little complicated, isn't it? Because if you're rooting for the Yankees and I'm rooting for the Red Sox, and it's a taut contest, and the Red Sox win and the Yankees lose, let's say, counterfactually, although in recent history that's not so, and I'm disappointed and you're elated. And then I remember that game. I was the one rooting for the I was rooting for the Yankees, I guess. I'm disappointed. I remember that game tinged with sadness and regret and another loss. And you remember that game in this triumphal mood and, you know, pumping your fist. So there's not universality. I mean, this.
Yeah.
I mean, where's this Kantian universality?
Well, but I mean, you got to rely on Hume here. Hume says, well, you need somebody who's not really involved to make the objective judgment.
Even if you're involved, give you an example. the first real good rugby game I saw was the opening game of Stadium Australia, and it was Australia against New Zealand, so the top derby in rugby. And Australia had beaten New Zealand 10 times straight, which was a record. That never happened before. That night, opening game of Stadium Australia, they lost. And then on the way home on the subway, everybody was extremely happy, and I couldn't believe it. The next day, the headlines were the best game of rugby ever played.
Well, that's going to take
so that. This Australians were sad, but nevertheless.
I'm going to take that up in a little bit some more. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is athletic beauty. Our guest is Hans Gumbrecht from Stanford University.
We've been examining how much the experience of beauty matters to our appreciation of athletic competition. Coming up, we'll ask what, if anything, is distinctive about aesthetic experience in the case of athletic performance. And you can join us. Call 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Beautiful bodies executing beautiful moves in the face of sometimes stiff competition. Plus, your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
The Bellamy Brothers with their classic, If I Said You Had a Beautiful Body, Would You Hold It Against Me? This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And there's a certain double entendre to that title, you know. And I'm Ken Taylor. Our topic, athletic beauty. Our guest, Hans Gumbrecht from Stanford University. Are athletic competitions beautiful? If so, are they beautiful because of the competitive element or despite the competitive element? Tell us your thoughts.
The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And you can also email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
So, Seb, I want to grant you that a well-played competition is often, not always, but often a thing of beauty. But I want to know whether there's anything distinctive about the beauty of athletics. Does the beauty of a well-played contest differ in some deep and substantive way from, say, the beauty of a finely executed painting or a play or a song or a dance or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't even claim that everything that I can subsume under athletic beauty has something like a common denominator, you know? If you would say there's a wide range of things, of experiences that we call beautiful, then part of that range would be the segment of aesthetic beauty. I mean, in that book you so kindly talked about, I make six distinctions. I will not go into any detail. I would say two things, perhaps, that are something like a common denominator. I mean, your good friend Kant, Immanuel Kant, K-A-N-T, makes the distinction between the beautiful and the sublime. And the formula for the beautiful is purposiveness without purpose. The impression that there is a purpose, but there is no real purpose. I would actually claim that in the majority of those cases that we call beautiful in sports, it is rather beauty than the sublime. The sublime being something overwhelming, something that you cannot assimilate. I mean, that exists too, but that's one thing. The other thing is it is different from a painting in as much as there is always a movement involved. There's temporality involved, which is not exclusive for sports, but necessary for sports. I mean, there's no object of that we would call beautiful in an athletic event that does not move.
Let me take you back to something you said about the appearance of purposiveness. But you know, it's kind of a little bit tricky because in a way, sports have real purpose. I mean, in one sense they have pretend purposes, and another sense they have real purposes. I mean, the guy is really trying to hit the ball over the fence. He's really trying to hit the ball over the fence. And now here's something that's a little funny. It doesn't matter. I mean, if he has a beautiful swing or not, if he hits the ball over the fence, the ball goes over the fence, it scores, a run scores, and all the runs on base score, and it counts toward the final score, whether or not. Now, other things, it's not just the mere purpose. Other sports, it's not just the mere purpose, but the way you carry out the purpose. In gymnastics, it's not just getting over the bar. It's getting over the bar with a certain form that matters to your success. I mean, so it seems like, I don't know.
No, it's complicated, the whole thing about purpose. I mean, there are two things to be said. I mean, one, I would insist in all cases, of course, and that's true for aesthetics in general, it's disconnected from everyday purposes. So let's say that you love a picture and that you get something out of it, as I was saying before, will not promote you professionally, with the exception of our own profession, and will not increase your bank account. The second thing I wanted to say, it is an impression. See, I think, yes, I mean, a good swing, Tiger Woods being the problem, Tiger Woods' swing was off. But if you appreciate that swing, you do not only appreciate it in its functionality. You know, Barry Bonds, local hero, I mean, for me, he's a hero, certainly. Sometimes he hits a home run and say it was a majestic home run. And I think this is not just random. I mean, there are certain home runs where the swing, the way the ball flies, where it flies, and so forth, and so forth. And it may have to do, you know, with the sunset and whatever in the stadium. There's an ensemble that creates that impression that you will not forget. So not every home run is equally beautiful.
Well, to take two examples from my youth in the 50s, Mickey Mantle hit a home run that I think actually went out of Yankee Stadium, 511 feet, headlines all over the place, but nobody remembers the game. Bobby Thompson hit a real gamey home run in the Polo Ground, so the Giants beat the Dodgers in a playoff game in, I don't know, early 50s off Ralph Branch. The home run only went 298 feet because the Polo Grounds were actually Polo Grounds and not the right shape for a baseball stadium. And Bobby Thompson's swing wasn't anything to write home about. But within the dramatic element of the season and of the game, everybody remembers that. It was called a hit heard around the world or something like that. So I'm with you, at least for baseball. Now, when we get into demolition derbies, I don't know about this aesthetic beauty business.
Well, there's an interesting question that was once asked by a guy in a Japanese friend and sports fan, and he asked me whether, and I think it's a good question, I don't have a very convincing answer, whether there were ugly plays or whether there's only an absence of beauty. My hunch is that it's very difficult to characterize certain plays as ugly. For example, I mean, if you have seen this famous head butter that Zidane, the MVP at the recent Soccer World Cup did, you can call that ugly. If you want, I wouldn't, but I mean, normally a bad game in baseball or in football or in soccer or in hockey, which I like a lot, is not so much a game where there are many plays they would call ugly. They were just not good.
Well, you haven't watched enough Little League baseball.
Listening
to Philosophy Talk, we're talking about athletic beauty with Hans Gumbrecht. You can join our discussion by calling 415-841-4134. And we have a caller on the line, Paul in Albany. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Paul.
Yeah, hi. I have a couple of comments. One is, when Jack Ramsey coached the Portland Trail Blazers, and he was once asked, after they had won the championship, "Well, if you weren't a basketball coach, what would you like to be?" And he said, "I would like to teach dance."
Mm.
And he saw basketball as a form of dance. Now, he was a particularly different kind of coach.
Was he successful?
Oh, yeah. He won the NBA championship.
Yeah, okay.
With Bill Walton, who a lot of people, of course, wouldn't have had on his team, you know, because they didn't think he was a dancer. They just thought he was a pothead. You know? But the point is, when you talk about teams like, say, Leeds and Manchester United, you have to understand, these people are reliving the War of the Roses. You know, this is Yorkshire versus Lancashire. This has nothing to do with the actual game that goes on the field. And if you, I have a question for the person who said that they were on their way to Nottingham and that the train went through Manchester from London, you must have been really on something strange, because Nottingham is only halfway between London and Manchester.
Well, thanks.
Well, Bob. I guess I got off first.
What's your?
I mean, my reaction is that I think if you look into it closely, there are lots of very successful coaches who, when asked in a long enough discussion, would actually make this aesthetic argument. I mean, I come with two soccer examples. I mean, the great surprise of the recent Soccer World Cup was Germany. Nobody thought they would do anything. They had this relatively young coach. Is that the first thing that Germany has to learn is to play beautifully, because Germany was always only very successful. Not then, they were very successful. Same with the guy who won the European Championship, a Dutch coach, Rijkaard. Is now let them play, let them develop what's beautiful. So that is an interesting thing. Again, it doesn't belong to that language, you know, to that language that's always suspicious of being sissy to say that. But I think it is true in many cases.
Still, let's go back to the dance thing. The basketball coach would have been a dance instructor. I mean, there is this difference between dance and basketball. I mean, they're both very graceful. You make very graceful moves in basketball. But I wonder what you think about what difference this difference makes to the aesthetic character. In dance, the other people on the stage are coordinating with you in a way that sort of helps you. They're not trying to stop you from scoring the basket, from executing the move, yeah. right? They're either feeding off your executing yeah. or yeah. helping you up or something. Yeah. In sports, often, it's often the case, not figure skating or gymnastics, the other guy's trying to stop you. Does that matter
no, of course.
To
I mean,
the aesthetic character?
In the book, I mean, it's boring to quote my own book on it. I mean, I say,
well, that's why we have you on, because you wrote this book.
The two motivations or motivators, as I'm calling them using Greek concepts, that's arete, trying to be your best, and agon. And agon mm-hmm. meaning the competition. So, yes, there is no sport without competition. Nothing would ever call sports, and that's the difference with ballet. So I would therefore say whenever, I mean, as I was saying before, whichever specific case you can describe is a complex case, and in sports there's always some drama in there, which is not necessarily the case in dance. I mean, if you watch the movie Dirty Dancing, you will know that there's drama too in there. And very often, actually, when you talk about ballet companies, there's a certain drama, love stories going on and so forth. But in sport, it's constitutive, so you can never completely detach what I call the beauty of the movement or, you know, the form emerging from drama. It is always permeated with that. And
I mean, suppose that when Shaq goes up for a dunk, then his teammates immediately, while he's in the air, would grab him by the hips and spin him around several times and set him down gently, as happens in ballet. Wouldn't that be even more beautiful than
no.
it is now?
I think the answer to that one is no.
You know, it's hard to imagine.
Yeah. We have callers on the line. Joseph in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Joseph.
Yeah, hi.
Hi. What's your comment or question?
Well, I just like to comment on on sports in general. I mean, why I like them, besides the fact that I like using my body to see what I can do when you watch especially professional athletes. Not even professional, though, even college. I enjoy college sports quite a bit. You're seeing people trying to do the best they can do, which is rare for humans, and so I appreciate that a lot. The other part is every now and then you see a human being exceed the limits of what is commonly perceived to be possible. I mean, I have seen a man fly. You may have too. So there's the aspect of it that it's live. It's actually happening. It's happening in real time. There's an incredible amount of improvisation going on. It's split second versus, you know, I mean, I have all these friends who, you know, they're, I don't like sports, and sports are this and that, you know, but they love Hollywood and they love all this. You know,
Joe, I remember my coach once told me I'd exceeded the limits of what he thought was humanly possible, but he meant he'd never seen anyone execute a tackle that badly.
Yeah, right. So, thanks, Joseph. Sepp, what do you think about Joseph's thoughts?
I mean, I think the pedagogical or ethical or whatever you can want to call it advantage and merit of sports precisely in that. I mean, it is an array, an institution that implicitly and inevitably makes you try to look for your best, pushes you over limits that you could normally not imagine to ever cross. So that's beautiful about it. And I think there's also something about it to watch that. I actually, in that book, once again, argue that was really the appeal of the ancient Olympics. I mean, for the ancient Olympics, the athletes were demigods, and it is interesting that the first examples of European poetry, of European lyrics, are odes in honor of athletes as demigods.
I grant you that. I mean, that all seems right, but I still wonder about the distinctive character of the aesthetic experience of sports. Because I want to take you back again. You said this Kantian thing, this subjective universality. Again, part of our enjoyment has to do with or doesn't it? Or am I wrong about this? The identification with a team or player, right? So I identify with Tiger Woods, and so I want to see him win, right? And anything that contributes to that. I mean, dance is, they do amazing things with their bodies, right? So you could see sport as like dance in that way. But I'm still trying to see, isn't it different because of the? I don't think we've got an.
Well, once again, you know, I mean,
is that thing that makes it different? Is that really aesthetic? Once I have these kind of atavistic loyalties and identifications, doesn't that take it out of the realm of the aesthetic?
I mean, if you go definitional, I agree with you. I would not include all the thing that I call drama or atavistic loyalties, or what we're saying about the Manchester United fan. I'd not have that within my concept of aesthetic experience or beauty. What I'm saying, however, and what I think is distinctive about sports is you do not have, there is no way to have aesthetic experience in the case of sports without it being permeated by things like atavistic loyalty, by things like drama and so forth. And I think that is the distinctive thing about it. And we tend to overestimate, I think, the loyalty, the drama and so forth. And that's all there. But I think it is only so good and only so specifically appealing because it is not just that.
Now, Joseph mentioned one thing, which was doing your best. Now, in your book, you mentioned that the really popular figures are often popular when they're losers rather than winners. Jack Dempsey versus Gene Tunney. Gene Tunney's the better boxer. Jack Dempsey comes out of the fight, he loses, is tremendously popular for the first time. Is this connected with the idea of somebody who's trying to be better than they are, to do better than they can, who's, you know, operating flat out, is a little more appealing than the graceful person to whom it comes easy?
I mean, it's not randomly you're mentioning a couple of boxers. That would be a specific thing, and I want to go for once into that differentiation. I mean, I think the appeal for boxing is above all to see a person expose himself or herself to death. I mean, I think if that is not there in boxing, however problematic that may be from a moral or ethical point of view, I think that's important. Now, I'm arguing, and I think no boxer can ever reach the top of popularity without at least having been in this situation. I would even include without ever having lost a fight. See, I'm claiming that Muhammad Ali would not be the mythological Muhammad Ali, and we wouldn't remember him the way we do, and remember his career as a boxer, as an athlete, had it not been for the one Frazier fight out of the three that he lost so smashingly. I think that is very, very important. I wouldn't make a general law of that. I think there are some cases, like, for example, greatest soccer player of all times, not arguably, it's consensus candidate, is Pelé. Pelé never had a bad moment in his career, really. I mean, he had very bad moments economically, but not as an athlete. I'm not saying it's an absolute necessity, but this is precisely this being permeated by drama, you know. I think this is something we like, and also it kind of highlights precisely if you win against adversity, it emphasizes this possibility of sports to make you cross certain limits that under quote-unquote normal conditions you would never cross.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing athletic beauty with Hans Gumbrecht from Stanford University.
We've been talking about sports as a distinctive kind of aesthetic experience. In our next segment, we'll ask whether the nature of athletic beauty can teach us anything about beauty more generally.
From athletic beauty to the beautiful in general. Plus more of your calls and emails at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org when Philosophy Talk continues.
Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention with an early musical form of physicalism. The ugliest part of your body is your mind. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing athletic beauty with Hans Gumbrecht from Stanford University. What, if anything, can the contemplation of athletic beauty teach us about beauty generally, more generally? Are athletic beauty and artistic beauty different species of a common genus? Is one form of beauty loftier, more sublime than the other? Tell us what you think.
Join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And you can email us, too. We've been a little light on the emails today. Come on, let's get those emails coming in. comments@philosophytalk.org.
So, Seth, I'd like to use a phrase, the beautiful as such, to quote my pal Plato. Does your account of athletic beauty help us understand beauty as such?
Well, I mean, I would like to emphasize, I think it makes us, me, help understand something about what we find beautiful today under specific historical and societal conditions. So, you know, we can go back to Plato at some point. I was doing that in a certain way because I was talking about the ancient Olympics. And I want to start by making the statement, it's an empirical statement, I think it's without, it's truthful empirically without any doubt. I mean, including ancient Greece, sports as a phenomenon has never been as large, as important, as heavy as in present-day societies. And that is true both for performing sports professionally on an amateur basis as watching sports. Now, why is this? So, and here's my hypothesis. I do think it has something to do with what I like to call the Cartesian everyday today. I mean, an everyday not as poor Descartes, your colleague, dreamed of, but an everyday in which all we need is our consciousness and our consciousness being fused to some software. I mean, I think for most of us, this is the way we spend our days. We spend them on email and so forth and so forth. I was recently telling somebody, you know, and now after we have been on email for 14 years, well, that's impossible, but for 4 years, we finally see each other and it feels like you don't really need to have a body in the face. I mean, we could perfectly communicate without that. So I think what sports explains us and the frenzy about sports explains in present-day society is not so much a need but a restlessness about what to do with our bodies, what place to assign our bodies in terms of investing them, practicing sports, but also in terms of seeing them and by seeing them and appreciating them, reassigning them somehow.
So I'm not sure I got this. It's something about our relationship. Understanding sports as an arena of beauty helps us to better understand and reconfigure our own relationship to our own bodily, our own embodiment, yeah. Right? And therefore, I mean, it helps us understand beauty more generally, because it opens up kind of the space of possibilities for the aesthetic,
I mean,
or something like that.
You know, you give me the possibility to formulate it, I think, better than I ever have. I hope so. In the sense that the basic condition that we are not aware of, but is we don't really know what to do with the body. I mean, the only times you know what to do with your body when it hurts, so you go to see a doctor. But if it doesn't hurt, why do you have a body? It's come completely superfluous, you know? I mean, us university professors, I mean, come on.
There is also the erotic,
Well, you know, I mean, we talk a lot about it, but I have my doubts about that. And well, anyway, I don't want to equate procreation with erotics, but if you look at the procreation rates of humankind these days, anyway. What I'm saying is that by practicing sports and watching sports, there is a possibility, a range of possibilities of, so to speak, and I think that metaphor is not so bad, to reassign your body. Say, oh, that's what it is all about. That's what it can look like, and so forth and so forth.
You put practicing and watching in the same breath. But don't you think there's a kind of asymmetry between the experience of the participant and the observer? Or how do you think about that?
No, there's a clear asymmetry. And I can say that because, you know, except for being vice champion of my state back in Germany in water polo, but there were only two teams, and I was 16 years old, I've never practiced sports successfully. So I'm a complete couch potato. There is an asymmetry, but the fact that there is a situational asymmetry does not necessarily mean that the appeal is so different. You know, there was a Stanford athlete, I'm proud to say, arguably the best butterfly swimmer of all times, Pablo Morales. And we had him once in the Stanford athletic department, a talk show, so to speak. And he came up and said, why was he so attracted by sports? And he said, it is all about being lost in focused intensity. Being lost in focused intensity. And I think in the first place, a very, very beautiful, compact description that works both for the spectator and for the athlete. So you get my point? Yes, it is asymmetrical, but this works for both sides.
I think there is this asymmetry between the participant and the spectator, but with the human mind, actually, there's sort of a continuum, because I tried every athletic venue that was open to me, and I stunk at all of them. But even so, you have enough experiences that you can kind of combine those with what you see other people doing, and you have this general sense of athletic accomplishment. Although I never scored a touchdown, I watched a lot of people score touchdowns at Stanford and elsewhere, and I kind of have this image of myself what it would be like to score a touchdown. So I think the athletic or sports dimension of the consciousness of a person like myself who's never been successful at it but has always been involved in it, there isn't such a clear asymmetry. There's just this big glom of imagining, anticipating. You watch Dwight Clark and you see it, and at the same time you feel what he must feel as he jumps up and feels the ball on his hands. And by the way, some of the best phenomenological descriptions, if I can put it that way, of athletic fandom are in your book. They're really great. I knew exactly where you were sitting in Stanford Stadium when you described the touchdown run you did.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about athletic beauty with Hans Gumbrecht from Stanford University. Give us a call and tell us about your experiences with sports, either as an observer or a participant. Are you a couch potato but love to watch? Have you tried to delve into sports yourself? Tell us about the aesthetics of your experience. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
We've got an email here from Fred in Fresno that says, I'd like to ask your guest to discuss the relation between the erotic and beauty in sports. Certainly in some kinds of sports, particularly figure skating or women's gymnastics, there is a definite erotic element. Is that just my own bizarre point of view, or is that something important?
I mean, in the first place, the contiguity or the closeness is similar to when you were talking about ballet before. I mean, clearly, it is an experience that does not only necessarily involve using the self-experience of your body. It focuses on the body. The body is in the center. So that is clear. Now, I would like to highlight an aspect that I've always been fascinated by and do not talk about in the book. That gets it even closer. I don't know whether you guys know, but I started out as a medievalist, specialist of medieval literature and culture. And in most European medieval languages, the most frequently used metaphor for sex, having sex, so frequently used that you ask yourself whether it was a metaphor, is actually lucha or fight. Yeah. So they talk about the act of sexuality as fight. Maybe that's very telling about how people had sex in the Middle Ages, but maybe it is also interesting in the sense that there is something agonal in the erotic experience that, I mean, not necessarily that you want to beat your partner, but you want to beat yourself. So there can be something performative, reaching higher goals. You know, very early troubadour poetry, for example, talks about a guy who did 188 times one night. Very unlikely even for the Middle Ages, but there is something competitive.
Pre-Viagra.
I want to ask you.
There's another book.
You're a big fan of sports, obviously. Your book is intense and full of phenomenological. I can tell you love sports and deeply appreciate it. Do you think these aesthetic experiences of watching a well-played contest are higher than or just different from the aesthetic experience associated with, you know, quote, high art, unquote? I mean, how do they compare?
Well, you know, I think that has, I mean, to do with your biography and with your own experience. I mean, at this point, I'm a Stanford professor of comparative literature, and in that role, I should embody the canon of high art, right? Now, the truth is that I got into that profession because, from my family background, I mean, I don't think my parents had ever read any classical text. They were two surgeons, you know, first-generation people going to university. So I have to say, until the present day, although you would expect the opposite, the entourage, the setting, the institutional framework of high arts can intimidate me or, if you forgive my language, piss me off. Uh-huh. And what I think is a great advantage of sports, and this is why, while I'm insisting there's aesthetic experience, I don't want to preach that and I don't want to convert people, is that you can have everything that an aesthetic experience offers you without feeling obliged. You know, you're even allowed to clap. Like, I mean, after a movement in a symphony, you know, a president of a university where I was teaching back in Germany, his wife clapped about the first movement of a Mozart symphony, and the president was fired. See, that is not, you get my point. I mean, it's very ritualistic, it's very starchy and stiff.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of going to a hockey game. I mean, you know, there's certain words you cannot use when you go to Memorial Stadium at Berkeley. I was using the four-letter word, and the person in front of me turned around and said, typical Stanford. But that's a Bay Area thing. But basically, you can say it, and you can rejoice, and you can have wet eyes and don't have to be embarrassed. So that's what I think makes it better.
I think I've got the answer to my question there. So, but Seth, on that note, I'm going to have to thank you for joining us. It's been a great conversation.
I thank you guys.
Our guest has been Hans Gumbrecht, professor of comparative literature at Stanford University, author of many things, but recently In Praise of Athletic Beauty.
We want to thank the callers we didn't get to, and we got some interesting emails that didn't get a chance to read, but we sorry about that, but thanks for the efforts. We appreciate it.
So, John, where's your head today? I mean, it's a pretty interesting discussion, huh?
Yeah. Well, you know, Sepp Gumbrecht is one of those guys that has brought so much life to the intellectual scene at Stanford in so many ways. But this is really a beautiful little book, by the way. It's the Belknap Press. It's In Praise of Athletic Beauty, and it's a book that you'll not only love to read, it looks really nice on the shelf. Okay, I'm convinced there is such a thing as athletic beauty. It meets the Kantian criteria for something aesthetic. I'm sort of convinced. I'm not totally convinced about the relative merits or the relative importance of excellence and competition in all of this. Next time I watch a football game, I won't feel guilty because I'm not at the ballet.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I don't think you would feel that anyway. I mean, so you just are rationalizing what you're already. But I'm not completely convinced that Kant's got the right analysis because of this subjective universality. You know, because it doesn't take account of the fact that we're differently situated with respect to the competitions. If I'm loyal to the Indians and you're loyal to the Yankees, then we're going to view the thing differently. You know, I might think bully for the Yankees, but, you know, boo-hoo for us. So I'm not quite sure. There's some formal...
Well, there may be some special category for Indians fans and for
Cleveland people
in general.
And I'm also not convinced that our deep love of sports is connected to so as much... As Gumbrecht says to the aesthetic, because I think it's these loyalties. I mean, it's like this ongoing romance, often unrequited. I mean, the Indians never returned my love for them with a World Series championship in my lifetime.
Yeah, but notice how America just doesn't respond to the success or failure of their soccer teams. So it's not just loyalty. There's something that Americans need education about, and you might say it's the beauty of soccer. If they don't have it, they don't have the loyalty.
So look, one of the things that we do on this show is solve conundrums. If you've got a conundrum that keeps you up at night, bedevils your imagination, go to our webpage, click on the Submit a Conundrum button on our website, and send us your conundrum.
I'm not sure we solve them, Ken, but we do discuss them. And by the way, you can download podcasts of our program from our website. A really fine thing you can do. You can now listen to Philosophy Talk 17, 18 hours a day if you want. For the last word on athletic beauty, we turn to a thinker who takes competitive philosophy to new aesthetic heights, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, the ancient Greeks were big on sport. The Lyceum, the fabled gathering place for Greek philosophers, was actually a gymnasium. So was that other famous school that Plato created, the Academy. The word gymnasium, by the way, is derived from the Greek word gymnos, or naked, which is how the guys in ancient Greece competed athletically. And it seems the rumors about the Greeks are true. There was a lot of messing around in the locker room, except they didn't have locker rooms and they didn't have showers. After an athletic bout, they would scrape the grime, sweat, blood, and other excretions away from their bodies with special scrapers called strigils. Forget the pallid bust of Homer, friends. These were rough and ready guys. It was the golden age of testosterone. Plato himself was a huge wrestling fan, and he was a wrestler himself. His actual name, it is believed, was Aristocles. Plato was a nickname he got as a wrestler. It means roughly broad. A bust of him has recently been discovered, showing him wearing ribbons, surmised to be prizes he won as an athlete. And the bust reveals something else as well, a cauliflower ear. Apparently somebody smacked him a good one back in the ancient day. It has been surmised that Plato was not just a wrestler. He was a competitor in the most popular Greek sporting event, the Pancratian, which means all-encompassing or all powers. In other words, free-for-all or anything goes. It was kind of the WWF of ancient Greece, only not fake. It had just three rules, so it is said. No biting, no scratching, no eye gouging. There are tales of dismemberment and death. One Pancratus became famous as Mr. Finger because of his talent for breaking the fingers of his opponents. Another competitor was disqualified because he ripped the intestines out of his opponent. Well, not for doing that, per se, but because he had violated an agreement that the contest would end after one more blow. Since he used all his fingers, that counted as five blows. I'm no referee, but I'd say he was robbed. Plato, some claim, won this championship twice. The Pancratian was by far the most popular sporting event in Greece. At the time, it seemed a legitimate part of Greek culture and thought, an agon, or contest, the root of our English word agony. Later, the Romans, lovers and degenerators of all things Greek, took the Pancratian and turned it into the gladiatorial games. Plato didn't include the Pancratian in his ideal republic, but he did refer to Pancratics as the folk with the battered ears. It sounds to me like he was talking to the mirror, maybe while scraping off stubble with a stridgel. I gotta go.
Ken, another great 60-second philosopher bit from Ian Scholes. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
We owe special thanks to Devin Strolovich, Neil Van Leeuwen, Ben Timpson, and Alan Farley. Our senior consulting producer is Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, including the Stanford Humanities Center, the Office of the Dean of Research, the Dean of Humanities and Sciences, and the Provost and President.
Also from the Friends of Philosophy Talk, the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.